Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Last of Us podcast, episode 15 on the 15th of January. Franco, how are you?
I mean, there are no words. Still emotionally recovering from that roller coaster earlier this evening. Holy cow. Holy cow. But glad to see you, though, my friend.
Great to see you too, mate. And look, honestly, thank you, first of all, for adjusting with the shifting of schedules. I think for the Mandalorian and other ones, we'll just wait until we know exactly when the episode premieres and stuff. And hey, people out there, TPN, let me do it full time so that I don't have to wait so late, you know, right? Okay, so let's all come together. But before all of that, so does the day find you well, mate? You're looking fantastic. You've been jogging or something. Yeah.
Thanks, my friend. Since the last time we talked, yeah, I think I was either in or coming or on the back end of COVID when we last spoke. And yeah, I'm feeling great. I've got my Joel Miller beard is working a little bit more. I've got my watch that is working. It is 3 a.m. here on the Eastern in the Eastern U.S. So so I'm good. Maybe a little loopy, from the episode, but also just the time too. So I'm glad to come together, though.
No, the reason why I ask about there was something visceral when watching it that I turned to Ray constantly, and we were just riffing back and forth about like how, you know, The Last of Us in all adaptations is an exercise in gratitude. It's an exercise in being like, I'm grateful for my health. I'm grateful that things aren't as bad as they are clearly in this world. And then obviously on that human level as well, with like that erosion of trust. So let's just, hey, folks, by the way, welcome. This is the community side of The Last of Us. You know, there's a post show, I think, with Troy, the official one. So we're on the Topic Podcast Network. Been doing The Last of Us podcast for a number of years. So hello, Julia. Thank you so much for joining. I think you might have the details, Julia. If you can join us, let me know. If not, I'll send them to you again. I think these ones should just really be just honest off the cuff. I'm thinking about that boy, not from the game, that boy coming into the city. And I just couldn't. How are you as a dad seeing something like that? Like, it's insane.
It broke my heart. I mean, Albert, it ripped my heart out. And I think this is going to happen several times throughout the show because we are seeing that. Hi.
Hi.
This is Julia. I didn't mean to. I just wanted to. I'm just bringing her in. This is, we're all sort of piling into the Last of Us podcast bus right now. But yes, Julia, Franco, Julia.
Hi, pleasure.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so, but yeah, please continue, Franco.
It is a testament to the genius of Neil and Craig that, you know, we all know the story beats by heart at this point, right? And the fact that they can come up with a moment that just makes your jaw drop, that is new content. I think it was Craig's credit, you know, he was asked already, how many seasons can this go on? And he said, this is not going to be like The Walking Dead or The Witcher or other, and no offense to that content, but where they're having to come up with new content. He said, this show will last as long as there is content from the game and no longer. So the fact that they stayed so true to the game's content, but come up with this moment to show you the deadly seriousness, and the way I explained it to my wife, who unfortunately, God bless her heart, I made her, she's not a fan of the series. She's not a fan of post-apocalyptic or zombie or graphic content. I made her watch the pilot with me. And after that, I said, you are absolved from having to watch anymore because that was more than I had expected.
Mrs. Adler, that's all I got to say. Ray was grabbing me when Mrs. Adler, out of focus in the background, was like, her mouth was opening and like contorting. And Julia, just to take a quick how did you deal with that, Julia?
Well, I watched it. I woke up very early today to make it to you guys so I can watch it, you know. And my story with The Last of Us, I started playing. I didn't finish because it's very long and I'm not a pro gamer. I really, really play for plot, so it's very hard for me to not die. but I that was, you know, I was wondering how they will do it because some parts of the game are really like 15 minutes. And in the show, it's explained a little more. You get more context. So that particular scene...
Sorry to interrupt. All I was going to say is, speaking of Franco, I think, you know, I Ray and I watched Chernobyl through. I watched it on my own, and then I watched it with her. So Chernobyl is a really, it is my favorite, like, just unconnected to any of these new major properties and stuff, or even, you know, secondary, tertiary, whatever, sort of sized, you know, worlds and universes. For me, Chernobyl, as this, I think it's just 5 or 6 episodes, something very, very short form. But that, as you said, Franco, like, there is no indulgence here. Everything is purposeful. And when they opened in the, like, complete cold open to a 1960s talk show, where it was just very calmly, academically laid out that this is something that, with very, very little artistic license, if at all needed, could happen. Where there's, again, there was something, you know, there's pre and then post, you know, Oppenheimer, Ray, you know, Ray and I have been talking about, we mentioned that, and then Julia and I also discussed, like, there was a world pre and post, knowing that something that like that was even possible, like an atomic bomb kind of thing. And with this, it was, yeah, COVID. Again, obviously, people are going to immediately make that COVID. Even there's even a phonetic, like COVID, cordyceps, CD, you know. And yeah, that calmly explained feasibility of it is chilling. And I remember early on with Last of Us, for me, the feasibility is what really, yeah, really got to me. Yeah.
You know, you hear as a fan of the source content, you know, that they're going to start the show with not that riveting opening scene. Because last time you and I talked, for me, we talked about when you hear that ticking of the clock or the watch, as it were, you know, you're in for like a really immersive, serious experience. So for them to start it with something different, immediately you're skeptical, like, okay, are we already deviating from the source material? This is the most revered video game narrative of all time. How are you going to, but it worked. You're right. It completely set it up with believability. The other thing is, I think in scenes like with Nana, right, where she's devouring her family and comes up with Claire and this the little boy in Boston, I think that Craig and Neil were going for a shock value and not shock for shock's sake. And I'll get off my soapbox in a second about that. Not shock for shock's sake, because you know the series does not do that, but to set the tone of there's the world before and there's the world now. And then the rest of the episode was about the bleak reality of life post-cordyceps. Shock for shock's value, I think I may have talked to you a little bit about the Callisto protocol that came out about a month ago. What a massive disappointment that game was. I have not fit. I'm about halfway through. The game is 8 hours long. I'm about 4 hours in, and I put it down and walked away. It is such a massive disappointment, because it is so much gore and shock in your face just to try to shock you, and it doesn't work. I think it's a miserable game that I did not enjoy a moment of. And I hate it.
I cried out that word to Ray when it came to just this experience of seeing this first episode. I was like, I was so grateful for this the nuance and subtlety of so much with the zombie thing. It's so interesting. There's a cyclicality happening where what Last of Us did for zombie games, which was to basically say, look, Ray actually phrased it really beautifully. She said, look, there's enough that's kind of spookily scary about the natural world. Like, as you know, Jonathan, from The Mummy and Sliding Doors, amazing, great, and aging fantastically, by the way. But yeah, this professor explaining that this is something that a fungal kind of multi-organism but sort of unified intelligence would do. And you know, especially during the Nana scene, I was kind of to sort of break that level of, you know, terror of that moment, which again, still understated with just the tendrils coming out the mouth, which once again, these things aren't necessarily feeding, they're just spreading. And I said, Ray, think of it as cells. Like, that's how on a cellular level, we're not frightened of it because it's so tiny happening, but on a cellular level, one cell sees a healthy cell, which is like maybe an infected who sees a healthy cell and then just runs to it and infects it. And that's it. And it's the terror of what's happening on a cellular level, but happening out among, you know, again, 6 foot tall, like normal human beings. And Nana having that reserve of adrenaline, that's what's terrifying about what this fungi intelligence can do. It can unlock in the same way where you hear about, you've heard of the stories of like mothers that they have this surge of adrenaline to lift a car up off of their kid, right? That's what this virus does. And it was depicted so beautifully. We rewind it a few times. You guys remember when they're in the city and it's absolute chaos. You can't tell who's infected, who's not. Mm-hmm. And they turn a corner and he's holding his daughter. And it's that one, his head snaps up like insanely fast, not in a horror movie way, not in a like The Ring kind of way, but just because that fungal intelligence has completely overridden the muscles and eliminated all human inhibition. Because again, how I move my hands and how I walk around the world, and that's all being processed through a filter of, hey, I don't want to bump into that thing. Hey, I don't want to come across as terrifying. But Cordyceps erases all that. And when that infected throws himself at Joel and his daughter in that kitchen, did you see? He threw himself at those pots and pans.
Yeah.
Like, fucking terrifying.
Ugh. Julia, what was your big moment? Did you have like an absolute jaw dropping or tear jerking moment?
Well, tear jerking for sure, because in the game, when you start, you actually get the connection to Sarah by playing her, right? Yeah. So you get emotionally attached by this 10 minutes of playing her. And in the show, we get to know her a little from a different side. We cannot just be her, you know, but we are observing her. We're going to school with her. We're going to watch with her. And, you know, the way that she's looking at the knife in Joel's drawer, that was, you know, she's fascinated by it. And we get to know her a little bit more. And that's the connection that's building. And obviously that moment when you realize that when it's going, she's gonna die, and you see how Joel is with her. He's reserved. He's a little bit harsh, I would say. But and in that moment, when he's holding her in her arms, that obviously, yeah. I did cry. I was ready for it, but I wasn't ready for that kind of emotional thing. And what you said, that the shocks, that's something that is like in many shows, those shock moments are so tacky and so cheap, and then you just watch it and it's like, oh my god, seriously. But in this show, it's just brutal, but in a very tasteful way, however weird that sounds, it's very tastefully done. For me, as someone who's not very in the like hyped, of course I am, but I'm not gonna compare the game to the show, because I haven't played at all yet. But those times, like when Sarah is in the Nana's house and she's like in the big, oh my god, that was so scary. That was just terrifying.
We just didn't understand what was happening. Like, and what basically was happening is this beautiful buildup of you know, you hear about Jakarta on the radio or on the TV, then you hear the sirens, then you see jet planes, and then you hear the helicopters. But even before that, just I was actually thinking, okay, so to kind of, retroactively maybe reverse engineer Craig and Neil maybe wanting to do its own adaptation, not and again with that subtlety and nuance, there was never anything where I was like, this performance or this character direction is like, you know, showing tood to the original, like, oh, we're gonna go in this different direction because we're different. Everything was like that beautiful scene of her bringing the watch to the lovely like Arabic, you know, you know, watch Repair plays. I found that so endearing. And now, once again, we'll play the original and think about her going to that shop again, just like Rogue One does. You know, the best that an adaptation or even a prequel or whatever, like something that Expandquel does, is make us appreciate the original. And I turned to her, I was like, I'm sorry, but I mean, I love this Sarah. Like, I love this yeah. adaptation so much. And that's it's almost insane that I'm even saying that because of as you said, Franco, the level of reverence for the original. I was going to actually go through beat by beat, guys, and we can do a roundtable on the scenes. Is that cool? Only if that's, you know, all right. So,
cool yes. here. I just want to acknowledge one thing that Julia said, though, which was about, oh, darn it. You had such a good point. The fact that in the opening, we can't play Sarah. So they spent the right amount of time and the right amount of the right additional nuances and letting us see who she is, letting us see a day at school, how she interacts with her how she's sweet to her neighbors, like but she still is a little flippant as a teenager with the raisin cookies. Like, they let us into her world so that we build that connection with her, just to kill her off, and not for shock value, but because we have to understand what a seminal moment, what a fulcrum in Joel's life that her loss is. And you get that when you're playing the game, because you are Sarah. But then because you don't have that option, the interactivity, they really build up Sarah in such a way that I think her loss will resonate throughout the rest of the series. Sorry, go ahead.
No, very much so. And such an impactful, you know, obviously if brief, and again, there's very much the potential for flashbacks, because, you know, it does avail itself of that. But, you know, Pedro obviously stand out. Bella, for her, comparatively lesser, because again, it really, I think, crucially and beautifully took its time, where we got to spend that time with the, you know, just that, not like to that appreciation of normality. So yes, Nico Parker as Sarah Miller, heartbreaking. So I'll bring it up here, we'll get started. So I've brought up just an article from the LRM online, but basically yes, episode one, titled "When You're Lost in the Darkness." We'll be doing this across Topic Podcast Network. When you go to the episode, our episode's entitled the same as that one, makes it a bit easier. So to find the events of this episode needed to be executed properly in order for the series to work. And as we were just saying, kicks off with the talk show scene where two scientists are being interviewed. The topic is global pandemics. One of them suggests the dangers of a plague that no one is worried about, brain controlling fungi, which, by the way, is a real thing in ants. Look it up. That's true. As excited as I was to move the story along, a sense of dread came over me as we started to follow the introduction of Sarah, Joel's daughter, played by Nico Parker, which, once again, this series, and I'll do a roundtable just on this handful of scenes, an exercise, Franco and Julia, in balancing of tones, because you have this moment where even, you know, the talk show host is trying to do this, hey, you know, yeah, mushrooms, right? Hey, mushrooms. Yeah. And because it's the 60s and he's trying to kind of bring things back into that talk show territory. But it reminds me of some of those great monologues, like in Jaws, you know, talking about things getting really serious with those sailors, you know, spoilers, 3, 2, 1, being devoured by sharks. There are so many monologues I can point to that give me chills, but I was honestly not expecting this scene, which, by the way, the seriousness won out. For example, there may even have been a version of this where they tried to do like, oh, that's never going to happen, and it would have been really jarring. But no, that scene legitimately ends in dourness and seriousness of like, okay, oh. And then it cuts to the extremely charming pancake scene, you know what I mean? Of them having that. And again, no one beats Craig, as demonstrated in, and Neil, in both Last of Us and Chernobyl, just extremely natural, uncontrived dialogue. Because it's just people speaking and having quips. And I loved all of their little jabs at each other as like a father-daughter. It was really great. Yeah.
You know what the the talk show scene reminded me strangely a little bit of two films it reminded me of. I'm just remembering the second one now. The first one is in the first Hunger Games when all the tributes are being interviewed by Caesar Flickerman, right, for the talk show about the Hunger Games. And and you've got the Mockingjay sitting there like, are we all sitting here? I'm about to go fight to my death along with these other kids, and we're all sitting here having this conversation about my dress. Meanwhile, the professor in The Last of Us is sort of like, do you all not recognize that with a couple degrees shift warmer in our climate, that this can absolutely go from ants and other, invertebrate creatures to humans? It doesn't take much, and it wouldn't just be cordyceps. It could be any of these other, other species.
Craig did his research.
Yeah. The other film that it reminded me of was in Don't Look Up. There's a scene where there's a newscast, and I only saw the film once, so I don't remember it terribly, but I'm pretty sure Leo DiCaprio and his co-star are sitting there trying to explain, there's a giant fucking asteroid coming to Earth and is going to kill all of us, right? And they're like, that is so exciting. Okay, weather coming up at 11, right? And they're like, no, you have to understand how serious this is. It kind of reminded me of both of those, but again, with a gravitas that you can't explain if to someone who hasn't read.
No, and when I think of the comparison of this, and also again, asteroids, extremely feasible. The cosmos is just this big black dark thing that literally anything can come out of, right, at any moment. I admire the boldness of beginning with a scene like this. What's funny is I'll just bring it up here. So I've got the stream here. Obviously, for content reasons, we can't stream it. But what's kind of interesting is I can zoom in on the little preview thing, and you can get a little bit of a sense right there. And again,
that doesn't count, right?
Yeah, it's so pixelated, obviously not. But what this does allow me to do, even on black, you can see, hopefully the subtitles will come up and we can talk about them, but or not. See, once again, I think Frank Herbert said it is like beginnings are so delicate, but the key to them is for them to feel uncontrived and undelicate, and just there is so many cuts, especially also pleased to whoever the editor is of this show, like absolutely like hats off to the level of confidence in this editing, it was truly a pleasure from an editing point of view. Ray has, and I think both of you agree as storytellers, you can really mess up something on an editing level. You really can. I think, especially with chaotic scenes of like tumult and yelling and stuff, you can again put people off. But especially when again, heartbreakingly, the 20 years pass and the pace of the episode slows down. I can't bring it up here, but you guys remember. So it's at the talk show angle, right? And you can see the presenter and the two interviewees. But when Jonathan is starts to explain it very seriously, there's an Alexei, as in from Chernobyl. It pushes in on him, right? And that was obviously they had that scene covered from different angles. That's how it is on films. But that was a very good editing choice. I think editing is one of the unsung pleasures of excellently made sequential art. So
that pushing. Go ahead, Julia.
I just wanted to say that for me, that slowdown, it kind of resembles like a wound that you get, like a shot, like a gunshot wound, or just like a knife. So they slowly get in the knife and they twist it, and then the 20 years pass and you're still bleeding. And that's how this show for me is going to be. It's going to be a wound that's soaking up all the time. It's going to hurt. It's going to be bleeding all the time. It's not going to kill you. But you're gonna feel it, and for me, that this episode was like this, like the beginning. I texted my friend, who, by the way, watched this at 3 a.m. in the morning.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because he had to work. I texted him, okay, I watched it. Now my anxiety is rising. So what do we do not to, like, what do we do with the climate? Because honestly, that was my thought. Like, are we really there? If we really go with those climate changes, will this happen? Is this for real?
Julia, okay, I'm sorry to screw you, but I'm sorry to do this. And I don't profess to know all the details, but simply on a sort of Occam's razor instinctive, you know, comprehension, it's like planet Earth hasn't known anything like humans and hasn't known anything that has inflicted itself on the planet as aggressively as humans has. So we can then reasonably expect there to be similarly unprecedented consequences to that. Not to put any fear in you, but
no, obviously we like, you know, COVID happened and nobody expected it to go that badly. It was a pandemic, and when you start watching the show and like you guys mentioned, it's so calmly and scientifically explained. I immediately paused.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay.
All right. Oh, yeah.
Speaking of that calmness, we need to think about what we're doing. Like,
I'll actually go back. Check out. This is how it starts. And you can see even the little counter there. And I've zoomed in on the sort of subtitle field. And so the first line is, and that's your biggest worry. You know, and it's a perfect way to cut in. You know, and yes, any kind of virus, but most probably something similar to the influenza. 1968 is when this is being said, because of air travel to influenza. Yes, because of air
and
travel.
That, and by the way, what a smart way to start, because we are all, there's not a person on Earth who is not intimately familiar with a respiratory spread influenza-like virus, especially by air travel. Like, no one is not familiar with that. So you immediately center yourself in what this other person is saying, which is a great way to set up. It's a great way to set up your own skepticism of what the other professor is about to say about fungi, the fun mushroom thing, right? Instead.
That's also very early on. You can see someone coughs, you know, a new virus in Madagascar could be in Chicago in a matter of weeks. We end up with a global pandemic, pan meaning all, the whole world becomes sick all at once.
And, it's just relatable. It's the easiest way to relate to people. It's something so common. It's like a cold or a flu, you know, and it's just more, a little more severe, as we find out. And the kind of what Franco said, the scene from the movie. Oh, my God. I flipped the title. What was it? The Leonardo DiCaprio one.
Don't look up.
Oh, Don't Look Up. Yes, obviously. Yeah, very good movie. But the scene, it was really hilarious. And I think the movie was very underappreciated because it was kind of touching a very severe subject and something very real. And it just showed how people, how elite, how politicians, how media would react. Because they would just be like, oh, okay, well, here's Ariana Grande. She's going to do a song for us, you know?
Exactly.
That's just it. And that's how the host of the show was like towards the second scientist telling him about the fungus. It was like, well, okay, it's not that. You're just making it sound so serious, and it's not. So that's another thing.
Thing. Cupcake Thief is just backing you up, saying, you know, this idea of having those serious, you know, concepts presented to the wider public and people, as you're saying, Julia, shrugging it off as not terribly realistic and scary these days. Again, just like Don't Look Up. I mean, we've gotten so used to bad ideas that most of us would listen to watch an interview and say, meh, we'll see. But it's the meh, we'll see attitude that lands us in that sort of, again, that allusion to global warming. Which is also chilling. And this is something that Craig did with Chernobyl. There's a breakdown, a couple of articles where they broke down, like, you know, Chernobyl, 80% science correct, like, but maybe this, there was a bit of artistic license used. So that line is very chilling to know that the baseline temperature, you know, an organism would evolve based on a temperature shift, you know? I would have to do my research of that, but it feels feasible. It's like terrifyingly realistic, just on an instinctive level. So thank you.
Plausibility of it all. It's the plausibility of Chernobyl because it actually happened and it was an actual horror show. And then it's the plausibility of of a simple mutation of a simple organism that, you know, would bring down what we are, which is nothing more than another species, a very dominant one. We are apex predators on Earth, but, you know, it, not complicated to bring us down. And Julia, by the way, you made a great, great comparison to a knife wound that festers over time. That's what elements of this show will be. That's a really apt comparison.
Very much so. And apologies for interrupting earlier, Julia. Sorry.
No worries. It's I for me, like I'm saying, I'm here for the ride, and I really do like those post-apo climates. It's something different than my usual take, you know, Star Wars, Star Trek, and Nolan. But this is something very real. And it's sometimes when you think about it, it's what Franca said. We are the worst species on Earth. Humans are the absolutely worst, the disease, and we're sadly not the cure. So it's I'm very interested to see where it goes, but it started off on a good note for me. It's a great show, and how you said about editing, you know, sometimes there is a fine line between chaotic editing of those scenes when they're driving through the city and making it look like you're on the edge of your seat, and it's you're there in the car with them. You're absolutely terrified. How are they gonna? Are they really gonna drive through the people? Like, is that tell them? Gosh. It's like, is this where we are as humans? Is that how you would react having to protect your daughter?
We had a moment. Ray and I, we were like, would we have stopped? And I actually turned to her. I was like, I think if we were gonna look at karma, then him driving past that family who seemed, at least from the distance, not to have been infected, that they, you know, maybe those three people died because Joel didn't stop to pick them up. And, you know, Spielberg would also have a lot about to say about, you know, earned, unearned deaths or whatever, but that idea of him doing that and then that leading to Sarah, I don't know, like
that is such an important point that I hope that fans of the show who are new to the series, who never played the game, come to understand, which for me is this: Joel Miller is not necessarily a good person, right? Mm-hmm. Like, perhaps he is the hero of the show, although debatably you could say that's Ellie, and it probably, frankly, is Ellie given the arc of the rest of the series. He's an anti-hero, which, you know, we all love a good anti-hero, but he's not necessarily a good person. Now, I think he's been made a lot, he's been made somewhat cheerier in the show in the beginning in the way that he relates to Sarah, because if you recall, when he comes in at the start of the game, of the first game, you know, he kind of drops down on the couch and he's exhausted and he's like, I do not have time, you know, Sarah, for whatever you're doing. And she's presenting him a watch, and then he's got to eat a little bit of crow, like, oh, you're giving me a present. Sorry, I'm a jerk.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
He's, when you look at his decisions, right, like passing by this family, you can see that he is somewhat selfish. This is probably not a guy who volunteers, you know, at the hospital down the street. Like, he's going to do what he has to do to protect his family, but he's not going to care about yours so much. And then you've got 20 years of him smuggling, and killing in Boston. And when by the time we really meet him, he's not really a good guy. So then that gives you a decision like, hey, I'm playing as this character who's making choices that are maybe ethically, morally questionable. Am I a good person if I'm going along with this? I don't know. Mm-hmm.
But no, you said anti-hero, but does it make him a villain in your opinion? Do you think he's a villain? Okay.
Good. I don't think so, because he would have to have, to be a villain, I think you would have to have malice and evil in your heart. Whereas all Joel's ever trying to do is survive and endure.
Game Off On says, yes, we love Joel, but he is not a good guy. Selfish, surely, but he will do anything for those he loves, which is the duality of selfishness, is that is certainly what will help you survive for 20 years. Ray and I also paused the thing to talk about what will get you through. And clearly Tess and Joe will have a shared sense of, look, she had this insightful observation about how Joel has gotten ahead. He knows he can skip cues. He knows the guy sending these radio messages, and he's embedded in, but it takes a ruthlessness, you know, to go down that route. And you know, in war and in survival situations, ruthlessness is you'll survive because of it. And I think what we're going to experience is a more nuanced and grounded, you know, take on what it takes to survive in that world. So thank you, Game Off On. And
can I ask both of you, and Albert, I know you have a plan for the episode and going through the beats, but I have a really kind of burning question I want to ask you both, going back to editing for a second. And you talk about, you know, number one, Julia, the fine line between, you know, tacky editing or tasteful editing. And then Albert, you know, you mentioned how easily you can kind of screw something up, right? Do you have any criticisms, large or small, of this first episode?
Genuinely not. And that's not from like a fanboyish place of, like endlessly, you know, smoke blowing. It's always a disservice to do that. I think it was executed confidently, perfectly, really. Really, truly, 10 out of 10 for me. Go ahead, Julia.
My only criticism is not really like a, let's say, objective totally. One. For me personally, it's way too scary. But that's just, you know, I'm anxious person, you know. I'm like in very, and for me, it's...
Well, you don't want to go over to Miss Adler's house, Julia? You don't want to have cookies with Miss Adler?
No.
You don't want to have raisin cookies?
If you ask me this question in a week, when I will rewatch this first episode probably a couple of times to, you know, catch all those Easter eggs and do the in-depth analysis, maybe I will find something. Right now, for me, it's just I was on the edge of my couch under a blanket. I was like, can I look now? Can I look? after just watching it once, and I'm sure down the road you will realize that I'm the kind of person that watches things a million times. I will be able to tell you, but this is a really good question. And what about you? Do you have any criticism?
Clearly, I must have one if I ask that, right? Although not necessarily. I do have one, which is hard to say because who am I to have a criticism except just a consumer of the media, right? But my one criticism, and I did see this echoed in a couple quick flash reviews that I read after the show ended, was the moment of Joel and Tess realizing Ellie's her sickness, or that she had right? That was not handled, I think, through editing particularly well. It needed a moment to breathe. And I think the reason for that is you are compressing several hours of gameplay into 85 minutes, which was done masterfully. You've got to add in the exposition in the beginning of what we're talking about. You've got to add in Sarah's story. You've got to compress all of the Boston QZ all into those, you know, 85 minutes. It's hard. It's an impossible job. And I was thinking about James Cameron, who's famous for having gone frame by frame through all 3 hours of Titanic, right? And probably did the same on Avatar. That level of there's no fat in this episode. It's all muscle and sinew, and there's nothing to cut. But that being said, I wish that they had maybe, you know, cut 30 seconds out of something with Sarah. We would still love her. But give that moment where Tess is like, wait, you're infected? Give them a little second to breathe.
A little too quick, yes.
I
agree, yeah.
Hey, that's good. And and just on that point, I mean, you're both completely wrong, but it's okay. No.
Okay, it was nice. Bye. We gotta go now.
I'm totally kidding. Love you both. See that scene there, where actually was an interesting choice to have. We focus on Joel in that moment, and he looks at his bloodied fists of like, I just beat up this man who, yeah, I might not have liked the guy, but I was doing deals with him. I just beat him up for this person who I've now have found out is infected, you know. And again, he has been throwing infected children without a second thought into a pile, burning them, and then shoveling the ashes into bags, which are then used as sandbags. I mean, that's fucking, like, he is. And so, yeah, okay, so we have Derpy501 saying, and I know the virus spreads to show because of audio clip released a couple of days ago, but I won't be that guy. Look, basically, Derpy has a little chain of comments talking about, the point of the ruthlessness and the point of the terror and the fr and it's so funny that moment of the, things getting a bit echoey and it focusing there. There was a moment that I interpreted to be like, Joel is already his compass started like wavering when like the battery deal didn't go through. Like he is not comfortable with things not going like in this way where he has survived. He shovels his ashes, he does these deals, and that's his life. And he's just kind of like a broken watch. Like he's just there. Time is still for this man.
He's existing. He's not
He's
living,
just
right? He shovels his ashes. He drinks his whiskey and gets up and does it again the next day. But it's an existence, not a life.
beautifully expressed. And
And then something changes in him when he beats the cop. The way he pauses and just look at his bloody knuckles. That's something is changing in him. That's maybe the moment the clock starts ticking again. But that's just a maybe. Who know, like this moment, he already knows at that point that this smuggling will not go the way it's supposed to go, just because they did what they did. Because what Ellie did, she tried to prevent the secret going out. But it, for Joel, it's like two things happening at once. One is the smuggling, the deal that they have to follow through, and his personal demons. He couldn't save Sarah. He thought he's gonna feel maybe something after he beat the cop up, but I don't think it's going to work. But maybe, just maybe, the clock started moving for him again,
But
in that moment.
when he beats the cop, who is arguably probably the closest besides Tess, it seems like the only person he's got is like a friend, right? And then he beats this guy to death. At that moment, we paused because my wife was, she was like confused. She's like, "Wait, but did that guy kill his daughter?" And I was like, "No, that
No,
guy
not that guy.
was just the subject of probably 20 years of rage bottled up inside of Joel at himself for not being able to save Sarah, at the soldier for killing his daughter, at the world for victimizing him and making him, live through this existence. And he took out that rage on this person because of he saw the flashback in that moment that who was standing in front of him was not his drug dealing friend, soldier. It was the guy who killed his daughter. And he just took out 2 decades of rage on that person.
Yeah, thank you. And Ray also pointed out like his level of unhingedness resembled an infected. Like his level of something just snapped and he just launched in, like tendons just turned into like hot lava, and he just barreled for the guy as there was this almost tragic and poetic in a way attempt to rectify a wrong that is so far in the past that there's no way that he can ever atone for it. But because of the context, again, the soldier with the flashlight in his face, it was very effective. Absolutely. So my little scrub along, shall we call them those scrub alongs of the episode's dialogue? Why not? I think it's additive in its own way. So a great question fielded. Again, a very beautifully off kilter to sort of throw you off, but in a good way. Where do we get LSD from? And then the cheeky show host, where do you get it from? Which is like a question that people are asking each other in the 60s a lot. It's like, where do I get LSD from? And it's beautiful. And let me just rephrase. Obviously, Binge is like, yo, you're toeing the line. No law's being broken. But I am gonna kind of refresh on you a little bit. I'm gonna make it a little bit tricky. But
We won't tell.
We won't tell if we won't tell, so don't worry.
Well, if you won't tell, okay.
And no one in your global audience right now snitch either. We're just trying to.
Well, it doesn't like it. One thing I would love to do, and I'll probably do this for the next one, but I will find some way because you can just do this in like code or whatever. You can just grab the dialogue so that we can scrub through because I really loved how the professor kind of broke down In fact, maybe if I don't actually share the window, I think we should be good. And I'll just read it for y'all. Okay. How did you like Joel's beautiful, subtle southern? So I think that was very subtle. You know, Pedro did that quite well with his very subtle kind of southern twin.
Do you know that was a criticism? That was the only other criticism that I had read somewhere that I kind of thought about was Pedro's accent, that he is not the greatest and he slipped in and out of it. And I don't think he needs to oversell that. He just needs to just be solemn. And you know, I thought Bella did an extraordinary job with her accent. And as did Nico Parker. When I saw Nico speaking, there was a little brief making of afterwards. I didn't get to watch all of it, but I had no idea that Nico Parker, who, by the way, I guess is Thandie Newton's daughter, and you see the resemblance.
There's so much a resemblance, totally. Yeah, no, I totally get that. Yeah.
But the talent these actors have to mask their own accents with others is pretty incredible. So,
and here comes me with I'm not a native speaker, so recognizing accents is like I don't even try. So for me, that's like the least of my focus. But this is a good point. I will read some more about it. Like, is it something very serious to pick on, like the accents? Or is it the show starting off so good that people are just looking for things to, you know?
And I think it's a duty. So because we can uniformly agree that the show is a masterpiece, objectively, I think, right? Critics, it's sort of their duty to find the little things here and there.
Oh, yeah. Critics, yeah, it's in the title. The
beats that could have been better. Yeah. I actually even thought from the title sequence...
Sequence, Franco, you can't just talk about that. You can't just expect me not to rudely interrupt you, which I'm very sorry about right now. But come on, Gustavo.
Yeah.
So beautiful. The spreading of the tendrils. Excuse me.
Did you guys notice at one point with the title sequence that one of the mounds is a skull? It's a human skull.
Like a human. Mm-hmm.
Being open. I only caught that when watching a replay of the title sequence. I did notice a couple of criticisms. One criticism that I saw in the title sequence was someone said, did it really need to be so long? And the Game of Thrones title sequence at least builds the, every time you watch it, it reminds you of where things are, right? It's got all the different worlds and it builds out the worlds so that you are centered and grounded in the world and you know where everything is. But other ones, for example, Westworld, show that I love, and others that have very long openings and title sequences, do they really do anything? And, you know, The Last of Us, you kind of get tendrils building a city so that you understand that now all of our structures and life is dominated by this, right? You get a human skull to show that you know, now humanity is dominated by this. Now, I will say this. That criticism was in the Rolling Stone article, which you can go and find on my Twitter, and it's all over the internet. That was written by someone who was very much not a gamer, has not played the game, has not watched any walkthroughs of the game. So they may not have connected the power of the game's opening sequence with the masterpiece itself. So I don't think it was a criticism that's there, but I don't agree with that criticism.
There you go. And for me, one thing that, again, you guys are podcasters, if not very, very soon to be seasoned podcasters because of all the damn TPN shows I'll be bringing you onto, you will understand that at some point, there's just going to be things where people like bring up an opinion. And I honestly, and I sat, and I love you very much, Franco, and it wasn't your opinion, you were just informing me of another person's opinion. But all throughout, and I can imagine myself reading that opinion and being like, there's nothing here. I may as well be looking at a blank piece of paper, like just nothing is connecting what you're saying. Because it is, like I had a visceral, I turned to Ray and I was like, this is going to be great. We're going to have a good time watching this show, especially with that, you know, and HBO does this beautiful, and I don't really like the binge thing. But you know what we can do to counter that, guys, and I'm going to mini tease this now, because these two omni interested souls with me right here, I think you guys will find a lot of, let's just say this, we're going to be on a lot of shows, us three. We have to come up with like the brilliant boffins, like our trio, trio name, because I think I want you both. But I'm going to say this. When they announce, this is a little mini announcement. This is the only ads you'll ever get on TPN are ads about TPN, which they're not really ads. I'm just telling you about it. But basically, as soon as they announce Stranger Things season 5, I'm going to turn with you to both and I'll say, look, put my reading glasses and dip them on. Like, look, we need to plot out some schedule where we can watch seasons 1, 2, 3, 4 episode by episode, week by week or something. And we're going to, and this is what Julia and I are doing now with Nolan, where we're building up towards Oppenheimer. So start thinking in those terms, Franco, for like, you know, those, yeah, it's going to be a good time. So, and one thing that I hope we can do, again, we're likely going to miss a lot on this breakdown. You can then do rewatches as well. So it's, you know, you two do not know what you've gotten yourselves into. I'm talking, we're going to be riffing in like many decades. When we're podcasting with our minds, we'll still be doing
this. Well, and Albert, what I'll bring to that with Stranger Things is the perspective of someone who is new to it. I've never seen Stranger Things. I know.
That's so good.
Oh no, my God. But yeah. I used to be the person that, like, when someone was telling me I have never seen Star Wars, I was like, I'm sorry, we're not friends anymore. Yep. But now, oh my God. This is still ahead of you. I would give everything up to see it for the first time. So, Franco, you are in for a ride. And I was very skeptical about Stranger Things, but I watched like 4 seasons in a row, and I'm like, huh.
Love it.
Okay. I see. Love it. Understand. I understand why people were excited about it. So you are in for a ride.
Can't
we
wait.
Are. And this has been Construction Corner with Joel Miller. I like that. Do you remember? That was good. I like that. Where do we get LSD from? Dr. Newman says it comes from ergot, a fungus. Yeah. Psilocybin, also a fungus, you know, magic mushrooms. Viruses can make us ill, but fungi can alter our very minds. There's a fungus that infects insects. It gets inside an ant, for example, travels through its circulatory system to the ant's brain, and floods it with hallucinogens, which I didn't know about, thus bending the ant's mind to its will, right? Which gives me, again, love the tangents that come up with these, is what if at some point, maybe even in season 2, we open an episode with like a POV of someone beginning to succumb, and then what kind of hallucinations is this fungi making them, experience? And then we cut right to them, maybe doing something completely brutal and terrifying. And there was another, guys, you remember that line? Is like, there are worse things than infected out there. Obviously he was talking about the raiders and stuff.
Yeah.
But I immediately thought of this, I'm going to bring it up, but this terrifying piece of concept art of, I don't know if you guys have seen it, but from back in 2012, I think, when they were still developing it, The Stages of Infected.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so excited, guys, to see how much they've decided to riff on the infected life cycle. Because we do have like runners, we have, then the bloaters and all of that stuff. Then, gosh, 3, 2, 1 spoilers for skip if you don't want to know about Last of Us Part 2. But yes, the Rat King, the horrifying things. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to that, and just how strange and kind of alien it's going to be.
You know what? So here's a question on that for you both. One, I don't know that this is a criticism, but it was a change that that I think Craig specifically spoke to, that they are not using spores in the show.
Yeah. Oh yes. Oh yeah. We can talk about that if you want. I don't care at all. I think it's fine.
I don't mean a big deal. And I explained to my wife, I think the reason for that was because with the gas masks, that really would inhibit dialogue, I think. And is that the reason why they're doing tendrils instead of spores, to do away with gas masks?
I don't know. Do you guys, I haven't, I mean, I'll look it up. It's like, why spores? Why no tendrils?
Not in the show. I don't know. I think maybe that would be too much to handle for people as well. Like, so much going on with the infection itself. And there was this poster when they actually brought this boy, saying that, like, if you get bit here, it's 1 to 2 hours. If you get bit here, it's 4 to 6, and then 8 to 12 to 24. I think that was, you know, serious enough for people. So maybe they just wanted to limit it, so it's more easy to control later on the show. However, that sounds like keep it a little limited. Maybe that's why. But I don't think it's just because of, you know, the dialogues, because I think Pedro is pretty experienced with talking through the mask in The Mandalorian. So I don't think he and the cast would mind. That's my guess. I don't know if it's true, though.
I walked into that one about Pedro and how to talk through a mask.
No, that's okay. And I think, I think they would have found a way to make it work if they did. But you know, there's also something that's extremely, you know, fair, which is the transition from adaptations. I think that's actually one of the most creatively fulfilling aspects of an adaptation, is to just find these subtle ways to differentiate. And again, we have, you know, for a brief time, I had my heart in my chest. I was like, is that how they're mixing this up? They're going to, oh my God, it's all going to happen in daylight. Like that's the going to be, because I was anxious, you know, with the Miss Adler scene and all that stuff. I was like, we're going to have everything that happens in at night in the game, but it's going to happen in the day.
Right.
For a brief moment, I thought that is what was going to happen. So,
yeah, I had the same exact thought too. And I'm glad that they didn't. And then it's when you realize, oh, no, they're just building Sarah's world a little bit, and you're seeing a day in the life of Sarah, the teenager. And then it makes sense. I mean, you can't, the terror is in part because this is happening under the dark of night. And you can't, that is where having Neil Druckmann, who breathed this story into life, and having Craig Mazin, who recognizes the power of fear and darkness, working together, you will never lose, I don't think, time will tell, but you will never lose those critical little decisions, right? Yeah. That just bring the fear to life.
Speaking of bringing the fear to life, I would love for them to bring this concept back, which is, they would have to do it in a subtle way, because I think, you know, there's ratings agreed upon or whatever. But so this assemblage of this party, I mean, this dangling head there, it's just like terrifying. So if they did want to do stuff where things got really weird the further out you get in the world, that's going to be very intriguing. But just so that we're not spooking out too many people. You know what? I just realized we're coming up to the hour. I know we still have to figure out some structural stuff with these post shows, in terms of like how long we go for, how I'm going to be able to bring up materials and stuff. But I'm sensing that it's something that really connected with you both. And obviously, and I had my little joshing, winking thing of like, there's, you know, when you guys voiced your thoughts about some of the choices. But I think it's a 10 from me. We can go around if you want to score. I don't know if we want to do that. Have we transcended scores, guys? What do you reckon?
I think we can do scores, but I think we should come up with something, you know, clever, like, you know, 10 spores out of 10 or something.
The spore score in 7 episodes ago.
That's right. No, it's a 10 in the words of Simon Cowell. It's a 10 from me, even with minor criticisms. The other criticism, by the way, I was going to bring up about the title sequence, and I thought it could have been expanded, but maybe Craig and Neil, being humble as they are, I thought when you get to the end of the title sequence, right before The Last of Us displays, but when you've got Craig's name and Neil's name that appears, it rushes through it. It's almost like their names go faster than anyone else's in the credits. And it's like, guys, give yourself the credit, an additional second of your name appearing, because, you know, you are, besides Troy and Ashley and everyone else, like, you really have this art. So, you know, but it's a 10.
Okay.
Well, a perfect score.
Perfect spore. I love that.
A perfect spore from me as well. It's 10 out of 10 spores. 10 out of 10 would recommend. What I want to say is just one thing. The monsters, what you showed, the flower monster.
Yeah.
This is so clever. Like, they are beautiful, but so terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like this gentle way of saying, okay, this might kill you, but it looks nice, you know? And it's like this kind of, it's the balance. It's what I think this show is and will be. And the game is also like perfectly balanced. Like the monsters, it's something beautiful that just kills you, you know? It turns you into something very terrifying.
Something like this.
Something beautiful. Like when you look at it, it's easy to look at. That's why maybe it's, and that scene when Joel and Tess entered this building and she just got so scared because of it. When you look at, I paused it and I was like, this is so fucking scary. But on the other hand, it's easy on the eye. You know, I know what it can do. I know what it did to that person. It's no longer a person, but it looks like art. And
what
the show of contrast it's scary. It's scary as hell. But it is something contrasting about the tragedy, you know. And like I said, humans are the worst kind of thing that happened to Earth. And this is just it's very, it's something that really struck me for the first time when I started playing the game. And I reached the moments when I met those monsters and everything. I was like, this is so scary. Why did I have to make it so beautiful? Like, this is absolutely terrifying.
Well, one thing that Last of Us, not to, I don't know, I guess maybe sometimes I unintentionally, as we come up to the hour, I think of summaries and I think of, you know, what is the thesis statement of? And for me, the Last of Us thesis statement is there's an imbalance we brought from the point of view of our, again, this isn't a partisan thing, political thing. It's like, it's measurable. We have, just because of our species activity, like raised temperature of the planet and you know, gases in the air and stuff like that. So we've brought that and nature, you know, Crichton tapped into this a little bit as well with what nature's planning for us based on what we're doing. And cause she's minding us and wondering, okay, what do I do with these? And I think, this imagines us as having crossed a certain line where she says, okay, what we're going to do is you've gone too far. Well, I'm going to amend this. And that's what people were saying about COVID. They were saying COVID was nature sort of shaking us off a bit, shaking the fleas off her back and allowing those dolphins to come back to Venice and allowing these waters to run clear and stuff. And what I'm anticipating is obviously this is in a sewer and stuff like that, but imagine if, what we'll see when these, again, infected, they'll obviously the cordyceps is telling them to find a hard surface, spread themselves to it, and then basically turn into a flower, turn into this. Yeah. So
back to the nature, you know,
back to nature. And so there's this going to be this eerie thing of like, I'm just repurposing you to re-soil the earth, like almost like the cosmos or God or whatever saying like, start again, let's just turn them into fertilizer, you know? And make something beautiful, like beautiful flowers out of them. Let's turn everything back into fertilizer, which is something that when we do the Horizon podcast, which is post apocalypse, there's that machine, thinking towards like, how can we redo this? How can we wipe the slate clean? And but then again, you have these good people who obviously would never have thought to, you know, anger nature, make her angry, whatever, like they're left behind, but while ostensibly this greater plan is in motion to erase humanity. And that is very chilling at the beginning when he says there's nothing, we lose. Beautiful. And it's that the beauty of exploring loss and the clinging to hope no matter what, like finding the light in the darkness. It's the episode title, you know, when you're lost in the darkness. So that's my final take. Go ahead, Franco, and then we'll throw it to Julia for her final take.
You mentioned nature reclaiming, you know, societies and civilizations, which is a common theme within both The Last of Us and the Horizon series as well. One thing I'm really excited for, both in the show adaptation of The Last of Us as well as the upcoming Netflix show adaptation of the Horizon series, is
episode by episode. Yep,
both series handle landscapes and the natural world reclaiming civilizations so beautifully.
Oh, the skyscrapers leaning into each other. Oh.
I mean, it literally takes, there have been moments in both games, but honestly, especially in Horizon Forbidden West the Horizon series, because of the scope and the grandeur of where you are traversing, it just takes your breath away. And I'm really excited to see how these filmmakers adapt what is already pretty technically perfect visualizations of these environments into the film medium. I mean, because what a huge challenge. It's almost like, forget actors, forget set pieces. How are you going to deal with this already perfect beauty in nature and translate that and even one up it? I don't know if it's possible, but we'll see in time.
Beautiful. Love that. How about yourself, Julia?
Let me tell you this. I understand people fear about this show because I know how devoted fan base the game has, both of the parts. And it was very interesting for me to observe my friend who is a gamer, who is very much invested in the story, and how he was trying to stay positive about the show. And then he texted me 4 a.m. in the morning saying, "This, I love it. I love this show." And for me, as an enthusiast of everything, really, of the pop culture and those kind of things, I am amazed and I cannot wait to see more. And from the, let's say, critics' point of view, as of now, I have nothing bad to say about it, except I will definitely be thinking about the things that Franco said. And I really do like the concept of Joel being the anti-hero, but not necessarily the villain, which is something that I lack in today's TV shows. We either see a hero or we see a villain.
He's a demi-hero.
Exactly. And Joel is in between. He's doing wrong things. And he's ruthless, and he's maybe, I wouldn't say totally selfish, because there is an agenda, and deep down, he is very emotional. And this is the part I'm very interested in, like the psychological and emotional part of his journey and what clicked in him when he was beating this cop up. And I hate HBO for releasing only one episode a week.
No, I love it.
But then again, I love it because we're going to have so much to talk about, and it's going to build up the hype, the emotions, and we're just going to... It's the kind of thing that we have with Nolan. When you stop watching it, you immediately start thinking about it. And in 2 days, I'm going to be like, okay, I need to go back to this moment to see exactly what was there. And that's why I love these shows being released once a week. So... as of now, I'm just overwhelmed how anxious I am watching this. Like, anxious not in a typical way, but it's like, is this really like predicting what can happen? Is this what if for us? Or is it just pure warning, you know? So that's me, and I love it. I really love it. And I think, you know, we had a lot of, there was like, people are amazing, but also terrible, because when they find nothing wrong with the show, they will go for a cast that Pedro is not a good Joel, that Bella is not a good Ellie, and then Tess, and then everybody. It's like, the show didn't even air. Why can you make an opinion based on announcements, you know? So right. I think the cast made a great job. I cannot wait when we meet here next week, when we can talk about it. I'm over the moon. I'm really over the moon. And I love it.
I'm very glad. I'm very delighted to hear that. Well, what I'll do is, unless you would love to, or we'd like to, you know, let the people know yourselves, I'm happy to do it if you don't want to. But Julia, would you like to tell people where they can find you online?
No, but I can tell people where they can find you, you know?
Ignore her. So what you want to do is, you want to go to instagram.com/TwinPeaksCafe or instagram.com/ Julia Sawinska, right? And because I have my little... right.
Listen to him. Go to Topic Podcast Network. You can find everything there.
You know what? Actually, I'm gonna deflect and just say, so you got here, right here. Boom. Follow her right here. Twin Peaks Cafe. and it's TwinPeaksCafe.com as well. Then Franco is a badass because he's just grabbed Franco Ripple everywhere. I mean, it's like a gangster name, and you just like.
That's only because I'm old and I've been on the internet for a long time. I managed to get my name on every platform. Right. Follow me if you like. It's mainly pictures of my kids. But I will say, if you're going to do anything following this show, anyone who's watching, it's join the podcast, join the Topic Podcast Network as a Patreon member. Pay the man his money. Albert does a honestly bringing you this content. So
Okay, you are so sweet, both of you. What I will say, and you're just the most darling human beings, is that truly this whole endeavor with Topic Podcast Network, you can probably tell by what I called it, it is really no nonsense. I've just called it the thing that it is, so the Topic Podcast, which means actually, literally, that's the premise of the show, the tagline, is discussing everything together. Which has double meaning. It means discussing all different topics together, and then as people. And as Franco embodies and Julia as a legacy host who was there really in like the trenches of those early, really rough days. So the whole essence of it, and not to again sound all, you know, flowery language or whatever, but it's I really love people, and I think that there are so many unheard voices out there. Yes, exactly. As you've all you know, hopefully there's more than two people listening to the show, but as you've all experienced now on the live and on the replay, these two immensely insightful, you know, empathy led, you know, coming at things from a lateral point of view, truly, really worthwhile analysts, and take everything they've expressed, extrapolate that out to like Harry Potter and Star Wars and all this stuff, right? So if that describes not just someone that you like listening to, but if you yourself feel that, if you feel that inner Julia, that inner Franco, we have it. It's available for you, that you don't have to, but patreon.com/topicnetwork. Join up. I'm so vibey with it. Is that the word, Franco? I'm vibey because it's I like I just connect. Exactly. So gem, you can be a gem, it's like $3. You can be a champion, $5, and you can be like a legend, $12. All that basically means is it just determines how many times you can just jump on the show throughout the week. I'm also extremely empathy led, so I might just freak out and be like, oh my god, they've just revealed the trailer for episode 10 directed by Shireen Obaid Chinoy, which by the way is totally going to happen at Star Wars Celebration. They're going to announce episode 10. It's going to be non-Skywalker, but I'm fingers crossed. So imagine that happens. And if you guys are thinking right now-ish, we lead into that. Imagine the giant feel-good love party we could have on a stream like this. You know, StreamYard like allows like 20 people. And that's the vision that I have when I think of, I mean, one Franco's beautiful and one Julia's beautiful, but it's about the Francos and the Julias out there, exactly, that can maybe find their tribe here. It's not about me at all. It's just about what I can do to create this environment where people can connect. And then the second aspect is communities and creators, right? So bringing eventually to, you know, we've had some hosts who have co-hosted with, you know, authors and writers. Julia and I are going to be reviewing, like discussing Dune, which, you know, McFarlane Books just sent us a copy. So I've got all kinds of plans for this so-and-so Franco with co-hosting on a couple of different shows. We want to get Ashley Birch, obviously, to riff with her about Aloy's next big adventure. She seems really amenable to that. And so, yeah, just that's the extra little cherry, maybe, that it's like, not only is it hanging out with people, but I'm really invested in connecting like concept artists who, or even texture artists who like do all this hours and hours of work, but they never get to have a fan moment themselves. So yeah, just all of those in between conversations, and then all the way up to like directors and stuff like that. You know, we had a little bit of heat on maybe Jim Cameron coming on. He's very busy, obviously. We have the Avatar podcast, but needless to say, whatever my opportunities become through TPN because of your support, they immediately become your opportunity, like unfiltered. And then just riff with me. The reason why these two are on is because they were crazy and they answered my emails, and so that's what I mean. It's all very vibey and led from love. So I talk with way too much. It's not about me. Go and follow
Frank. It is about you, because without you there wouldn't be this show, there wouldn't be Nolan podcast, there wouldn't be Avatar podcast, there would be nothing, dude. So take your damn credit, like, you know.
I will.
That's right. Craig and Neil at the end of the credits, slow down, take your
exactly.
And if you're watching, share and subscribe and
as a family.
I mean, honestly, I think it's you said it was $12 is the top tier. Think about how much nonsense you spend $12 a month on. Just go do it.
Oh, and I will be haranguing you. Did you, Franco, can you speak as a patron? I was like emailing, I was like, make sure you don't. Oh my God, the time is like, I'm really communicative. And I just, if you maintain that riff with me, you honestly, youtube.com/@topicpodcastnetwork/streams. Every single one of those streams, if you're a patron and you want to be on the show, you just email me, I'll get you on the show. You know what I mean? So and it's based on like engagement and stuff like that, but I'm not going to let them have the final word. Go Franco Ripple, Julia Sawinska, love them, they're in the description. Big hugs. And Julia, let's ambush him. Can we get you, Franco, big hugs, can we get you on an upcoming Nolan? Is that cool?
Yes.
Right? How good would Frank be for... What's your favorite Nolan movie coming? Because we're viewing them all. We're talking about them all. Just don't say Memento because we already did that. Let's. Do you have a... Oh, my God. He doesn't like Nolan.
Oh, me? Oh, you're asking me? No, I'm sorry. Oh, no.
No, okay. Yeah,
my favorite film, I think, of all time is Interstellar. In fact, I have a plan. I won't say where or what. I have an embarrassing tattoo from when I was 19 years old, and I have a plan. Yours is beautiful, Albert, by the way. And I have a plan to cover it and expand well upon it with things from Interstellar, with more
stuff.
Gargantua and everything. Yeah. So that movie, I Nolan.
Julia, she's free. Julia is an actual Nolan.
I'm freaking out right now. I'm freaking out.
So the love is real. I'm so glad it ended up being us, the beautiful boffins, on this first.
We got to work on the name. We got to work on the name.
Really bad. All right. So lots of love. I'm going to take these two lovelies into the post show, which you get to join if you're a patron, whatever. We're going to hang out a little bit longer. But for everyone else, love and light. Thank you so much for joining. When you're lost in the darkness, look for the light. Bye, everybody. Bye.
Bye.